Of course, it will come to order. Time is 3:30 on the 30th of February. We have Senators Green, Stevens, Huggins, and Willakowski. Expect others to come, and I see my good friend Fred Dyson in the rear. Welcome, Fred. Today, we have an opportunity to hear from about geological, geophysical aspects of Cook Inlet. The intention of what we're doing today is to be educational. Anywhere from how much gas is there to the history of where we have been to get that gas and the future of Cook Inlet, if you will, interpretatively by, in this case, Bob Swenson. Bob, would you please come forward and put yourself on the record? And for those of you that are looking at your handout, it's the Tussie version with the rose-colored sky is what we're using for. I understand, Bob, that in yours loitering in airports that you revised your
goofing off.
Do we have another one? For please, Bob, go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. My name is Bob Swenson. I'm the state geologist and acting director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And if you don't mind, Chairman Huggins, would you mind if I turn the lights down to
start
the presentation?
That's
Thank
fine.
You.
Okay.
I appreciate you asking me to come and talk about the Cook Inlet. I've added just a couple slides from some of the other basins in and around Alaska that have gas potential. And just to give you an overview of some of the other state, but we will focus on primarily the Cook Inlet. The first thing I'd like to cover are some things. If you know, there'll be lots of geology and other things in here. I've tried to keep that to a relative minimum. But there are a few points that I'd really like to make sure that we do get covered and that I make very, very clear. First, because of market issues, focused exploration for natural gas in all of Alaska basins is really in its infancy. The lack of a large market to sell that gas has kept exploration at a relative minimum. Of the 36 plus TCF of gas, or trillion cubic feet of gas reserves throughout the state, nearly all was discovered while searching for oil. Probably close to 95% of the current reserves. Published resource assessments. This is something that I'll touch on fairly distinctly. You see very large numbers out there oftentimes in different basins around the state. These published resource assessments often have very large associated error bars, and I hesitate to call them error bars. They're really not error bars, but any data set like this that has a high variance will have a very fairly large distribution around a mean. The numbers that we normally see are a mean, and we'll talk to that some here in just a moment. Significant exploration potential exists in a number of basins around the state, and I'll touch on two or three of those basins. However, the economics and access to market will play a key role on what type of activity we will see in the future. That's a very key point. Then finally, Cook Inlet, where we will be spending much of this talk, most of the easy gas, and I don't mean to say easy in that term. It's the gas that was found early on was relatively easy or inexpensive gas that was found and delineated. The gas that we are looking at, the gas that I'll be talking about today, specifically in the Cook Inlet, will be more expensive to explore for and to discover. And hopefully we'll be able to make that point. Would you like me to hold for just a moment?
Yeah, we're getting oriented here. For the record, Senator Wagner has joined us. Bob, what you want us to ask questions as you do your presentation?
Whichever you'd like.
Since you have the trillion cubic feet reserves, would you tell us, in your estimation, if you had that number based on your data, what your estimate of the reserves are in Cook Inlet?
The 36 trillion cubic feet is for the entire state.
Right.
That includes the gas on the North Slope. And that gas is gas that is booked.
Yeah.
That's gas that is under production, currently under production, and what they know. And so that does not include gas that is has not, with even within the units or within the fields, that has been. The 36 trillion cubic feet is a fairly distinct number.
Right.
We will talk to the reserves potential of given areas.
And I have Cook Inlet? You'll be talking about
Cook Inlet, yes.
Okay, good. And for the record, Senator McGuire has joined us.
And then one additional point, I think it's probably important that I let other things that you should know about geologists. One, for sure, that they know exactly how to dress for any occasion, like this gentleman on the left here.
Uh-huh.
They're usually standing in the back of a crowd and constantly throwing trivial geologic information out there that nobody really cares about. They are never at a loss for descriptive jargon. And that to show that their relative extreme grasp of the natural world. And then finally, I'll probably be talking about a lot of stickouts in this presentation today, so make sure to stop me if I get going too much. Okay. The state of Alaska there's a reason that the topography is so complicated. As you see this is a digital elevation model, it's not a satellite image. It's because the geology is likewise complex. What I've posted here, the blue dots on there are all the population centers, all the villages around the state. The red lines are the only infrastructure that we have in the entire state. That's a big issue in any type of exploration that goes on in the state. If we take a look at just the sedimentary parts of the basins that have gas potential, these polygons represent those basins. And each of these basins has a very different and distinct potential. They also have a very different and distinct amount of data available to determine that potential, and that's a very, very key point. And that will come up again here in just a few moments. But I'll be
can I ask a question?
Sure.
Does a sedimentary basin mean that that's likely where there is oil, or is there is a correlation between that?
Chair. Yes, that's a good question. When a geologist talks about a sedimentary basin, really all that means is that it has not gone into any type of metamorphic, it's not a hard rock mineralized type thing. It's sediments that were either deposited in a non-marine setting or in a marine setting. And whether or not they have gas will determine, is specifically related to the source rock, if there's a marine oil source rock or a gas source rock. And the gas can be either marine or coal. And number of the basins in Alaska area, a lot of the biogenic gas is associated with those coals. So when I say sedimentary basins, really almost all of the basins in the state do have some potential. Some are relatively low, but we'll talk just briefly to that. Another thing that I'll hit on a couple times, and this is a very important issue, and this is the scale. The polygon that I put up in the center of this map is the exact square miles of the great state of Colorado. And the great state of Colorado is, in its own right, is a very rich oil and gas province. But just to put it into context, we have basins within this state that would nearly cover up the entire state of Colorado. And so there's a significant amount of area in Alaska that is really hard to understand when we get posted down by Hawaii and we're about the size of North Dakota. So it's important to realize what that scale means. So first, I'll just go through just a couple of the basins that really, of course, are in the news a lot that have significant gas potential. The North Slope, of course, tremendous gas potential. I won't go into any great detail, but just touch on it. The Barrow Arch here, that's just denoted by this white line, that's where we found most of the oil in the state, in fact, most of the oil in North America. Bounding that Barrow Arch is the Beaufort Sea and the Colville Basin. These two areas here have probably the dominant potential, of course, within the state for natural gas. Extending the Colville Trough out into the Chukchi Sea area is the Chukchi Basin, very similar geology to the North Slope geology on shore. Some slight differences, but a tremendous gas province. And you'll be looking at the reserve estimates from USGS in that area here just momentarily. And of course, Anwar in this area here. One of the areas that is there's been quite a fair amount of activity on the North Slope recently is the Brooks Range foothills. Here's the Saddle Roachit Mountains in Anwar here, Siksik Puk River, Anaktuvi Pass is here to give you an idea of the scale of this photo. The Division of Geological Geophysical Surveys has gone through a series of mapping programs in the last 15 years to map this area right along the foothills of the Brooks Range. It's an very important gas province, very, very limited exploration wells because of the gas that they did see in those initial exploration wells. Just to give you an idea of the activity, this blue square is this latest map in the Siksik Puk River area that we will be publishing this year. In the recent foothills lease sales, these acreage blocks were picked up by Petro-Canada, BPX, and a number of other companies. And it just shows that this whole area does have, and this is a gas province, and there is certainly activity in here looking at this. I'm talking with some of the geologists that worked at Canadian basins. The comments that I've heard is that this, and I agree with this, is that the Brooks Range and the Foreland Basin associated with the Brooks Range, the only real difference between this region and the Canadian Foreland Basin and Rocky Mountain Front is that the infrastructure. It's a very, very similar style of geology. We have a tremendous amount of limestone, same thing that we see in the Rocky Mountains. Okay, now we're going to jump to the other side of the state. We were up in the North Slope, and I'll jump down here to Bristol Bay. This is another area, of course, that's been in the news here just recently. Bristol Bay has what's often called the North Aleutian Basin. Very, very little data offshore. There's been a number of wells drilled onshore. The red outline that you see is the most recent State of Alaska annual lease sale. That was the first one held last year. It'll again be held again in March.
Would you just, on that map,
sure,
very quickly show us where,
sure,
King Salmon is with and Port Hyden, just for point of reference.
In here?
Yeah.
Right. At the most recent sale, the Shell oil picked up, I think, I forget the acreage, but spent about $1.2 million on leases on that onshore sale.
Well, what is the darker area? Is
there? I'm sorry. Yeah, I should have explained that. What you see is actually a structure map at the shows the thickness of, again, that tertiary sediment in this basin. And so as it goes from light to dark here, that just shows the thickness of that tertiary sediment. And I'll show you a seismic line that will essentially run along the coastline here and then run one that runs out through the one well that's drilled in this basin. And I'll point that out now. This was a cost well drilled back in 1980. It was a consortium of companies that went out and did a stratigraphic test just to see what was there stratigraphically, what type of rock and what potential there was. Following that, there was a lease sale, and there was $92 million in bonus bids at that lease sale in 1982, so a significant amount of industry interest. So here are those seismic lines, and I won't go into any detail here, but this line here, B to B prime, goes along the coast. It's 150 miles from here to here. And then one going offshore through the well from there. And it just shows the basement rock, which is this blue line, which the oil and gas potential in the basement rock is essentially zero. All the sediments that are above that, which get up to 20,000 feet thick, are actually potential reservoir for hydrocarbons. Any explorationist that sees these lines and walks away without saying that there is not significant potential for finding prospects in this area should probably not be an exploration. Another scale issue. We often hear about ANWR. This is the 1002 area of ANWR to scale with the Bristol Bay area. And so you can see the amount of area in the ANWR area in comparison to the Bristol Bay or North Aleutian Basin. So a significantly large area.
But Bob, in that respect,
sure.
as I recall, there's a number of refuges on the Alaska Peninsula. How does that come to bear?
In the onshore exploration, it definitely comes to bear. They're off limits for exploration for sure. The state land that was offered in this area was open, was state land. But in this region, I should point this out. The basin edge, I'll go back one slide or two slides. The basin edge actually is about in this region. It's just at the edge of the state lands. All of these mountains in here, of course, are all the volcanoes. Totally changes the geology in that region. And so the potential for oil and gas in this part of the peninsula is essentially zero. It's really in the near shore and offshore areas.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah. Do we have a rough estimate of how much oil and gas is there, number one? And number two, how do you get it to market? What's kind of the general
Through the chair, very good question. There's a slide coming up in just a couple of slides that will address your first question about the reserve estimates that are in the Aleutian Basin right now. The market issue, again, throughout the state is one of the big issues for exploration, you know, activity in any one of these areas. You know, commodity price will be a huge thing to jump over those economic hurdles. Okay, and then this one final basin before we move on to the Cook Inlet. This is a sleeper basin in Alaska. This is on the onshore Gulf of Alaska, and I'll give you some geopolitical data here to key in where we're at. There's Yakutat Bay. The town of Yakutat's located there. Malaspina Glacier and Bering Glacier there, and this is Kayak Island. So this is the Gulf of Alaska region and the onshore. Significant amount of exploration has actually happened down there. In fact, the first oil production in the state of Alaska in the late 1800s was at Catala, and that's located right here. You'll see all these different dots on this map. The green dots are oil seeps. The red dots are wells that were drilled. The onshore wells were drilled primarily in the 50s and early 60s. The offshore wells, were drilled in the 1970s following the discovery of Swanson River. They shot seismic in the offshore region, saw very, very similar structures and very similar stratigraphy. And with the amount of oil seeping at the surface here, they got incredibly excited about it. Unfortunately, none of the wells in this entire exploration program found economic reserves. And there is one reason for that is the complexity of the geology. This is a cross-section that goes from the Chugach Train here to the north all the way down to the Pacific Plate. And I'll show you what the Pacific Plate is doing here in just a moment in the fun part of the geology. But what you can see is we're dealing with a thrust belt, very similar to the Wyoming Canadian type thrust belt. It's actually deforming today. The seeps that we see in these green dots are located about this position on this section. And so lots of big, big, big structures. That's what got a lot of people like very excited. This is a type of structure that they saw offshore that they drilled. Unfortunately, the yellow colored sediment there was so thick that they actually could not get down into what they thought was going to be reservoir rock. They drilled down into 17,000 feet and never got out of it, what we call a syntectonic unit. And just
neither
to prove
oil, neither oil nor gas?
Neither oil nor gas. Lots of shows, tremendous number of shows, lots of indication of hydrocarbons throughout the system, but no economic reserves. To prove that we do actually have oil seeps in this area, this is a picture of an oil seep on Johnson Creek, which is essentially about 50 miles to the west of Yakutat. This is what a oil seep looks like. This one we estimated about a barrel a day is seeping out of the ground. And we're about a quarter of a mile from the Gulf of Alaska here on the White River, on the Johnson River. Okay, resource estimates. We'll probably spend a fair amount of time on this slide because it is so important. And I'll probably skip through a lot of the slides coming up depending on the time. And I would ask the resource committee to, if I've covered enough, if you'd like to cover more on some things, to stop me at any time, and we can go through some issues specifically. One of the boxes here that you see on this slide is probably the most important box here. These estimates were provided by both MMS and the USGS. They've done a resource assessment across the state. In fact, they're working on one for the entire North America, and are now working on a resource assessment for the Circumarctic regions. It's important to note, however, when you look at these numbers, is that the numbers posted are for technically recoverable reserves. And what that means is that if you have no constraints economically, if you have no constraints on surface access, if you have no constraints and you have unlimited money to do this, that you could recover those hydrocarbons. Now, we all know that the economic recoverability of these things are very different than the technically recoverable. So, second thing, the range of estimates of the volumes of gas are the 95 and 5 probabilities. This is a very, very important concept for everybody to understand. When a geologist is asked to give a number, he may say 5, but what he really means is somewhere between 1 and 10. That's why engineers and geologists very seldom get along. But it's important to understand that it's a rigorous analysis. It truly is a rigorous analysis. It's a probabilistic analysis of given the data that we have in a given area. It's trying to predict what type of technically recoverable reserves you have. The range, this 95.5 probability, the 95 number means that, and I'll just point at one of these ranges. Let's pick the offshore Beaufort Sea right here. The range is 12.9 TCF to 63.3 TCF. The mean is 32.1 TCF. The 12.9 TCF is the 95% probability. That means that there's a 95% probability that the number or the amount of reserves in this basin are greater than this number. So they're greater than 12.9. The 5% probability is at 63.3 TCF means that there's a 95% chance or a 5% chance that it is not greater than that number or a 95% chance that it's smaller. Does that make sense? And then, like any natural occurring phenomena, we usually look at these things in the distribution. And the distribution has a mean in it. So in other words, the most commonly occurring number when you do this analysis. They do a Monte Carlo on it and other things. And that mean number is 32.1. So it's usually in the 50% to 60% range, the mean is. It depends on what the shape of your distribution is. But the key point is that usually what everyone sees published is the mean number. What's really important to understand is that depending on how much data that you have in a given area is what that distribution looks like. So let's go to a basin that we have very, very little data in, like here in the Hope Basin. It says on the 5% chance that you're at 11.1 TCF. On the 95% chance, in other words, there's a 95% chance that it's going to be larger than that, it's zero. And to see a distribution that wide suggests that you have very, very little understanding and very little data. And so if you take a look at a lot of the basins in this area, you see a lot of zeros on the bottom because it could be, there is a chance that you actually do have no hydrocarbons. The mean numbers are often added together in that distribution. It's a good way to do it, but you have to understand that it's when somebody says there is in the Hope Basin there is 3.4 TCF, there's a wide range of distribution and probabilities associated with that number.
Yes, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just kind of curious how much exploration has been done in Southeast. I know there was some in Yakutat, as you'd mentioned years ago, and I see there's a little Gulf of Alaska sticker up there, but I'm not quite sure what section of the Gulf that refers to.
Through the chair, I'll back up just a couple of slides and address that question. When they talk the Gulf of Alaska, and then there's two different boxes on that, and one is the onshore, this region here that they did an assessment. The Gulf of Alaska is this part of what we call the Yakutat block. There are the wells that were focused on these structures. And then there was one well drilled offshore in the Yakutat area down here that had very, very good shows of both oil and gas. And that is the limit of the exploration in the Gulf of Alaska. But when they say, and I'll go back to the resource assessment, that box right there is all of this offshore region.
Is there any time in the near distant future that you're going to look in places like Chatham Straits here that appears to be similar to Cook Inlet, at least from a mariner's point of view and a chart?
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, one of the key issues for any hydrocarbon basin is the thickness of the sediments. The basement rock, which is exposed all around us here in Juneau, the basement rock has no oil and gas potential at all. Really, where the oil and gas potential is in the sediments that were deposited. In a place like Chatham Straits, the thickness of that sediment, and I don't know this for a fact, but I would be very surprised if it was thicker than 1,000 meters, maybe. And so it's unfortunately there's a thermal regime that would not be satisfied to generate the hydrocarbons without biogenic sources like coal, which you wouldn't see in Chatham Straits. So the potential, and I don't know the details on that, but the potential is probably relatively low to see that type of reserves or a basin to house hydrocarbons.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, can you just give me a point of reference on a trillion, let's say a trillion cubic feet? Mm-hmm. How much of Alaska would that fuel for how long a time?
Good question. Through the chair, a trillion cubic feet, 1,000 billion cubic feet, and I'll put this in context with the Cook Inlet. In 1968, 8.2 trillion cubic feet of gas was found. Currently, we have 2.2 trillion cubic feet left. Now, a significant amount of that, probably 60% of that, was from export and development of the Agrium plant. I think the Anchorage Bowl, the NSTAR distribution market, uses 260 BCF per year. I think that's the number. It's hard to remember that off the top of my head, but I think that's the number.
Yeah, Bob, would you just also mention the component of the export? There was a significant amount of that gas that you're talking about was exported. Would you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. The gas in the Cook Inlet, when they ran into the gas in Cook Inlet, after this slide, we're going to be moving in and talking specifically to the Cook Inlet. The gas that was found there, they found 8.2 TCF, and all of that gas was stranded. There was no market. To develop a market, to start monetizing that resource, they created both the Phillips and Marathon LNG plant, as well as what at that time was Unocal's fertilizer plant. The amount of gas used in both of those, I guess, export facilities, the LNG plant is more of the export facility, it probably makes up about 60% of the usage. I actually have a graph when we get near the end. There's a graph that shows the distribution of how much gas is being used within the basin. Okay, so just very quickly, Southern Alaska, 2 TCF of reserves left in the basin, a mean estimate of 20 TCF undiscovered. And now this is all of Southern Alaska. This is all of these mean numbers added together and for a 20 TCF of undiscovered conventional reserves. Central Alaska, now this is the interior basin areas, about 9 TCF undiscovered, again, a mean number. And then finally, Northern Alaska, greater than 33 TCF of reserves with a mean estimate of 150 TCF undiscovered, and that's for all the basins that we were talking about earlier. The proven gas reserves, so in other words, the booked reserves, the total here, about 36 BCF, a little greater than 36 BCF. Now, this was the 2000 annual report, so these numbers have been updated. Sorry about the age of the slide. The Cook Inlet makes up only about 6% of those total proven reserves, but still a significant amount.
And Bob, you said those were booked reserves.
These are booked reserves, proven, yes. And I can go back one slide here. The Cook Inlet, in the USGS's opinion, has between the 95% number is 0.7, 2.5 and the 5% number, and their mean number is about 1.4 TCF yet to be found. That's what we're going to
clarify. I've seen charts that have shown the Cook Inlet going down through Shelikof Strait, but when you say Cook Inlet, you're really talking about what we know of as Cook Inlet.
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's absolutely true, and we'll talk to that just in a moment. And I will go through these next slides relatively quickly. This, a lot of the stickouts of this talk are going to be talked about here. This is a geology map of the Cook Inlet area. All the red boxes are the units. There's been a significant amount of activity throughout the years. The Cook Inlet proper, where we've seen the hydrocarbon accumulations, is in this part of the basin. The stratigraphy that we'll be talking about in the gas is the Sterling, Beluga, and Upper Tyonic formations. The oil, because they're two totally separate hydrocarbon systems, and that's an important thing to understand. The oil is generated down in these rocks and has some associated gas. The gas, the 95% of the gas that's being produced in the basin comes out of the coals, and it's a biogenic gas and does not require the thermogenic hit. It does not require to be cooked to release those hydrocarbons.
And would you just show us where the Beluga coal fields are? So
sure.
People,
the Beluga coal fields are just behind the town of Tyonic, which is right in here. Okay. I think it's right there. Just a real quick thing on geology. I couldn't give this talk without going through some regional geology. This is what Alaska looks like with all the water stripped off the ocean. This is the Pacific Basin, the Alaska Peninsula, and why the Alaska Peninsula is there and why the Cook Inlet is there will become clear when I show you a cross-section here on this red. All the red triangles are our volcanoes that we work on at the survey. All the red or the blue are actually X's, and those are historic, over the last 30 years, I think, historic earthquakes associated with the downgoing slab. So the next slide is a cross-section there. So essentially, this is what we're looking at. Again, the Pacific Plate is subducting beneath North America. The rate that this Pacific Plate goes underneath the North America is about the rate that your fingernail grows. And so it's relatively fast. It's kind of amazing how fast that is. That's what creates all the earthquakes. That's also what creates the Alaska Peninsula and the volcanoes. The Cook Inlet Basin is a relatively unique type of depositional system. It's what we call a four-arc basin in geology. And Cook Inlet is actually one of the very few worldwide four-arc basins that have hydrocarbon accumulations. Most of them have so much volcanic activity that the rocks get plugged up and there's very, very little. But just because of the way the geometries of this basin are, it turns out that this is actually a fairly prolific hydrocarbon basin. The material that gets scraped off the Pacific Plate, and this here shows being thrust up, that's what the Chugach and Kenai Mountains are. And so this whole southern part of Alaska is dominated by this one system. This is how South Alaska was formed. Now we'll focus in on the Cook Inlet Basin. The basin is bounded by the Bruin Bay Fault on the west side. Anything to the northwest of that really has no potential. On the south by the Border Ranges Fault, this is the rock that you saw being scraped off of the plate that's now pushed up into mountains. And the Cook Inlet Four Arc Basin was filled in with non-marine sediment that actually was derived from interior Alaska. It was also derived from eroding the arc to the northwest and these rocks to the southwest. This block diagram shows that the Border Ranges Fault here and the Bruin Bay Fault here. Large fans coming off this direction. And of course, this is prior to when the marine waters came up and developed the Cook Inlet. And the geometries and understanding what the geology associated with is a very, very important part of this whole exploration process and what the potential of the basin is. What filled the basin up is this type of system. You had major rivers running down all the way down past Kenai for probably the last 40 million years. And part of that was the deposition of these different types of geologic formations, the Point Bar, and these are all very, very good reservoirs, very, very good reservoirs. The floodplain and channel abandonment type things are very poor reservoirs. The sands that are deposited by these river systems are what we see now as our reservoir for producing the hydrocarbons. All the other areas in between are what make up the coals. That's why we have so much coal in the basin. When you look in the subsurface as this basin continues to go down, what you'll see is a very complicated sequence of different types of reservoir rock. This is what an explorationist does. He looks at, tries to understand what the geometries are, and then make prospective plays out of those geometries and the understanding of that. We have many, many tools that we use to try to do that. One of the tools, of course, is looking at it in the outcrop scale. You can see the big, thick coals. This would have been the green areas in the photo that I showed. This lighter buff color stuff is all the sandstones that were deposited by these rivers that swept back and forth across the basin. In the subsurface, we use well logs. This is a classic example. This is a cross-section through the Beluga River gas field. And thanks to ConocoPhillips for allowing me to publish this back when I was the production geologist at that gas field. And you can see that geometry that I showed in those three-dimensional block diagrams. These are the reservoirs that are penetrated. Some of these sands will give up to 5 million cubic feet of gas a day out of them. Incredible reservoir and incredible field. Now, if you take and map at the base of this entire thick section and map this around the entire basin, this is what you see. This is a structure map and shows the thickness of that tertiary sediment. Incredible thickness. In fact, in the deepest part of the basin, this would be in the Nikiski area, in the deepest part of the basin, that coal, sand, gravel, and deposits are over 25,000 feet thick, so a little over 5 miles thick. It's an incredible thickness of tertiary sediment, and that's why we see the prolific hydrocarbons in this basin. Very, very complicated geology, though, within that, and that's going to be the next theme of this. Been a significant amount of exploration since the discovery of Swanson River Field in 1958. And lots of discoveries. This graph shows the exploration wells, the number of exploration wells drilled through time. So you can see in 1950, these wells were Swanson River Field wells, as well as over in the Nisqually Peninsula. dramatic amount of drilling through here, but all of these plays, you have to remember, were all drilling for oil. Nobody was looking for gas. They were all looking for oil. The only thing where we actually have dedicated gas wells, I have highlighted in red over here. By the time Prudhoe Bay was found, 1968, they had found 8.2 TCF of gas in the basin, no market for it, and a little over 2 billion barrels of oil, incredible hydrocarbon province. But at that point in time, it made no sense to go out and look for gas. There was 8 TCF of gas, and that's when they developed both the LNG plant and the Agrium plant to monetize those reserves. From a geologist standpoint, is from the gas potential in the basin. This is a field size distribution, and I talked about normal distributions. Field size distribution, it shows what the how many fields are for a given size of a field. So 100 BCF up to 300 BCF fields, we have a number of those fields, a bunch of them. Then we've got two fields that are in the 1.2 to 1.5 TCF range. And then we've got two fields that are huge, the two greater than 2 TCF range. What's very, very interesting about this is that normally, and if you go to any other hydrocarbon basin in the world, what you see is that this distribution is that you have a full distribution. There'll be lots of small fields. There'll be a very, very few big fields. And this will be filled in with a number of the other, you know, interim fields. And so that's really the exploration potential in the basin. It's an incredibly important diagram because this really does show what could be out there. It doesn't make sense for it not to be.
Senator Wildcat, what's the success rate when they're drilling for wells?
In Wildcat, you're usually around 10%. That depends on the amount of data that you have. It's very, very low in rank Wildcat areas. As you start gathering more data and with new technology like 3D seismic, all the new technologies, they're getting up to the 40 to 50% range in wildcat areas. Now, if you're infill drilling around existing fields, that percentage goes way up into the 70 to 80% success rate.
And that's an important point.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If you're in the known field area, high probability. Now, how does that correlate? I'm sorry. How does that correlate to price, though, and as far as activity in the inlet?
Yes. In fact, in a couple slides, I'm going to get exactly to that.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Bill.
I'm just curious. What is this? Is this the success rate in Cook Inlet? Are they having good success in Cook Inlet finding gas when they drill?
No, they're not. It's probably about that.
10%
right now. It's in new exploration wells. Now, if you're within infield drilling, or if you're drilling right next to existing fields, that rate goes up. But if you're out stepping out away from existing fields, a lot of the recent dedicated gas wells are actually drilling wells that were drilled way back in the 60s, that they saw gas in the shallow section and totally ignored it. And so they're going after those old opportunistic wells right now. And so it's, from a wildcat standpoint, it's really not, you know, specifically fair to make that comparison. And I, Chairman Huggins, am I keeping everybody going here? Do I need to speed up?
I'm already snoring. Continue on. Yeah.
Okay. This is the diagram, really, is the reason why we're here. And I know you've all seen this a number of times. This is the proven reserves and where we're at, 2007, right here. We're sitting on a precipice. The important thing to note here is that, again, these are proven reserves. These are booked reserves. This does not mean that it's the only gas in the fields. There's additional gas to be found within the fields, and there's also exploration gas, and that's what I want to address next, and what that exploration gas is. But it clearly is something that we all need to pay specific attention to. The days of having a significant amount of stranded gas are over in the Cook Inlet. So the questions, is there more gas out there? Absolutely yes. I don't think there's any geologist that would get up in front of this committee and say that there isn't a fair amount of gas left to be found in the basin. Where will it be found? It will certainly be found within the existing fields, and I'll have one slide to address that. It will also be found in new exploration play types. And what I mean by that, and there's a couple slides to address this. The majority of the exploration plays that have been drilled in this basin have been on very easily defined structures on seismic, big, big, big folds. And adjacent structures next to that. So what are the hurdles? One of the hurdles, of course, is limited market. I won't be going into any detail at all. I do encourage the committee to have the Division of Oil and Gas, Kevin Banks and his folks, come down and provide you. They're in the final stages of a major effort of study on the market, and they could be able to give you a full rundown of all the details of the Cook Inlet gas market. Complicated land access is another issue, and I'll have a couple slides associated with that. And then finally, expensive data and drilling costs. That's data acquisition. Unfortunately, the costs of exploration in this basin are relatively high when compared to other places in the U.S., sometimes as much as an order of magnitude higher. Okay, Cook Inlet, the potential here, I mentioned this earlier, only structure traps have been explored for and developed. Stratigraphic trap potential is really untapped in the basin, and I will have two or three slides on that. 85% of the gas was discovered early in the exploration cycle, as we discussed, while drilling for oil. Only 70 exploration wells, and this number goes up and down depending on what specifically they were after, were drilled strictly for gas in the basin. Nearly 1 in 10 fields is 2 TCF or greater than 2 TCF. That's an incredible, very unusual statistic. The four largest fields have 86% of the reserves, another very weird statistic. And then finally, the field size distribution, lacks discoveries in the 300 to 1.3 TCF range. And that's what we're here for, is to understand the potential of finding those fields. When I say that the only structural traps have been searched for, this right here would be a structural trap. We have a large anticline. That anticline with a cap rock or a seal rock will stop the migration of hydrocarbons and in this case, sealing both gas and oil. In the upper parts of the Cook Inlet, the only thing you see is gas because it's biogenic gas. Another typical thing we see in the basin is this, also explored for throughout the basin. Most of these types of plays have been drilled, these big plays like this. What has not been drilled are things like this, and I'll show you a couple seismic lines to show that the Cook Inlet does absolutely have this type of play. These are the big structures that have been drilled, very easily discernible on seismic data. This is Granite Point Field here. This is the southern end of the North Cook Inlet structure. This is North Cook Inlet Field. Then I say low-hanging fruit here because if you were a geophysicist and you looked at this in detail, you'd see that there's a number of things what we call direct hydrocarbon indicators on seismic data because of the variance in velocity of that seismic wave. Through gas versus water, you can actually see the gas on the seismic, and it stands out at you. If you were an explorationist and saw that, you would, wouldn't go home that night.
You going to show that to us?
I can actually zoom in on that if you'd like. It's very, very interesting. You can see one of the DHIs, a direct hydrocarbon indicator at this scale, and that is this right here. You can see that this structure has a kind of arcuate up nature here. You get a depth, and there appears to be a dip in it. Well, that's not real. What that is what we call gas pushdown. And because the velocity of the seismic wave when they're gathering this data, because the velocity has to go and it slows down dramatically when it goes through the gas zones, it takes longer for that wave in this part of the structure to get back to the surface to be recorded. And so it actually says it took longer, so it's deeper, or it takes longer time. This is the scale over here is time. So that gas pushdown is a very good indication that you have a major gas accumulation. This is what really we have to look for in this basin. It's the subtle traps. I talked about how the distribution of the sands are associated with the different river systems and the pinch out that you're seeing. You see it's very, between these two lines is very thick. Over here it's very thin. And what happens is that sands laterally will pinch out. The sands or the porous zones will pinch out. And if it's on a system like this where you actually have dip to it, that will stop the flow of hydrocarbons, and that is exactly what part of Prudhoe Bay is in a number of stratigraphic traps that have been drilled in the North Slope. So what is the State Geologic Survey doing to help us understand that? We just started this last year, a major effort to go out and take a look at the basin edge geometries and look for those subtle changes in the stratigraphy, and I'll just go through these relatively quickly. To help us understand where we would see within the basin those stratigraphic type traps. And we'll be publishing that information. Here's one of the thick sands that will actually pinch out laterally within the basin. When you bury this down to 4,000 to 5,000 feet and pinch it out laterally, that's an incredible reservoir to house additional hydrocarbons. this is exactly what we're looking for, and that's that pinch out that I was referring to, where you have relatively thick stratigraphy. All of this is that interbedded coal, sand, and shale pinching out laterally, and on a dipping surface like that, create lateral stratigraphic traps. Okay, just a couple more slides here now. The exploration land picture, another important part of this whole story. And I won't go into great detail here, but the purple line that's on here really outlines within that polygon where we have potential for gas. So any of the land within that area probably has some potential for gas. The light green areas are all federal lands. That's the Moose Range, et cetera. This salmon colored here is all native lands. And the state lands are in this kind of putrid blue here. And if we take a look at the lease sale or the lease acquisition, this is after the 2006 sale and the bids received. All the lighter colors are tracts that are already under lease. The blue areas are the bids received in this latest sale. And remember, the edge of the basin is over here and over here. And so you can see, just for example, where there's an inlier within that going towards the edge of the basin, you see a tremendous amount of activity. And so in areas where we don't have access, there certainly is potential. And so that's one of the issues as far as exploration goes.
Bob, could you back up just a moment?
Sure.
Kenai National Wildlife Refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And then you show the blocks there. That's within the refuge?
These blocks?
Yeah.
Those are actually, that goes along the Sterling Highway, and that's state acreage. And it was up at the last lease sale, and that's why it was picked up. During the lease sale, we only offer everything inside with all the squares in it. This is all federal acreage that is not up for lease.
Okay.
The Swanson River Field and the Cannery Loop and Beaver Creek Field are actually located within the wildlife refuge. Okay, very quickly, some non-conventional exploration gas in the Cook Inlet Basin. One of the issues for sure in this basin is that they ran into so much gas and so many stacked reservoirs that they had a relatively difficult time completing those fields. And what they ended up having to do, because of the variance in pressure, the gas that's located in this type of a sand associated with the gas here has a very, very different pressure. So if you open those both up to the same wellbore, what you have is that gas from this zone will actually go all the way up here and go into that reservoir because it's so much higher pressure. And so to get around that, what they ended up having to do is do what they call dual completions or triple completions. And to do that, they run a production tubing string down and just pick up just those two sands, and then they'd run another one down to pick up these three sands. This is just an example, and some wells have up to 50 sands perfed in them, like in the Blue River gas field. The problem that arises from that is when the water starts moving in on them, like here you have a relatively close gas-water contact. When that sand waters out, you have absolutely no way to get down there and shut that one sand off. You have to shut that entire zone off, and sometimes there's a number of zones in there. While there's plenty of deliverability in the basin, that's not a problem. But when we start losing our ability to deliver that gas, this becomes a problem. And to work that one sand over to make sure you get all the gas out of these other sands, you have to pull this entire tubing string out and do a major well work over to get at that sand. And so those reserves will become expensive as we see wells starting to water out. Another certain potential within the basin, this is a porosity permeability plot. I won't go into the details, but it just means the size of the little pore spaces between the rocks and the ability to move fluids in those pore spaces, so the permeability. The great rock that we see in this basin is up here. This is the stuff that produces a tremendous amount of gas at very, very high rates. There is a lot of sands that actually have relatively low rates. When we have a lot of a deliverability again, you would not even perforate sands like that, because you don't need that extra gas from that. But that is clearly a additional resource in the basin. This is a photomicrograph of a thin section of a rock. So in other words, taking a sand and slicing it incredibly thin, injecting it with a blue dye so all the pore spaces show up as blue, and then shining a light on a microscope through it. This is what the rock in the basin looks like, and all these pore spaces is where the gas is housed. And when they perforate that, it flows through those pore spaces. How do we get to the tight gas sands? Most importantly, you shouldn't despair. There's a lot of times when you perforate sands that you're not going to get gas. But again, it's going to be expensive. Tight gas sands have the potential to reservoir significant amount of gas. It's just the rate at which they'll put it into the wellbore because of the low permeability. For example, currently in the lower 48, they're producing gas from fractured shale. In fact, Red Dog Mine up in northwestern Alaska is doing this for mine energy. 20 years ago, that was totally unheard of. You couldn't even imagine producing gas out of a fractured shale. Now it's one of the hottest exploration plays in the lower 48. So technology does make a big difference. Good data collection is critical, and sound interpretation. And that's all the slides that I had, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
It looks like Beluga River.
It's actually the Fox River at the head of Ketchumack Bay.
Really?
Yeah.
Good moose hunting up there.
Yeah.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just kind of curious. You know, we've got the Mississippi River that seems to have a lot of gas down there, and then we've got the Yukon and the Kuskokwim Delta. Has there been a lot of exploration on the Yukon, Kuskokwim, or is it no. just nothing up there?
Chairman Huggins, through the chair, excuse me, Senator Stedman, excuse me. There's two issues there. One, actually, there has been some exploration. Most of the sediment that's been dumped out of the Yukon River and the Kuskokwim River has actually been housed within the basins. And you remember one of the early slides that I had up there, if I can bring it back up if you like. The Norton Basin is all the Bering Sea basins. In fact, the Norton Basin has some of the thickest stratigraphy in all of the basins in the entire state. And the sediment actually was carried out onto, you know, in that area. The thickness directly offshore is relatively thin from the Yukon to the Kuskokwim, but all that sediment actually has been transported into those offshore basins. Back in the 80s, there was a number of wells drilled by the majors out in those regions to do stratigraphic tests. What they saw is that primarily all the basins were gas prone. And that is one of the issues. And if we go back to the slide that shows the potential, some of those basins out there have actually a relatively high amount of gas potential. But the economics and the cost back at that point in time certainly did not warrant further exploration. They were, again, looking for oil.
Senator Wagner?
Bob, a couple of years ago, Escapeda was going to bring up a drill rig and drill the kitchen project. Mm-hmm. Are they still pursuing that? I haven't heard lately what their latest plan is, because apparently they had some problems with the first drill rig that they had put under contract.
Through the chair, Senator Wagner. Yes, and I'm not completely up to date what the most recent work is, and as I understand it, they had. The Jones Act, they got an exception from the Jones Act, so they waived from the Jones Act, which was a big, big issue. They started on acquiring the rig. The company that was retrofitting the rig had a contract with them for X amount of dollars, and as I understand, and this was out of the paper, as I understand, that company sold, and the new company would not honor that contract. And that's what I understand, and that's where it stands now, as far as I know.
Other questions for Bob?
Methane.
I'm sorry, Senator Dyson.
I'll give my questions to Tom.
No, go ahead, please.
On your first page, you said that there were market issues that were restraining gas exploration. Would you kind of explain to us what they are, sir, and what, if anything, we could or should do to help that?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson. when I said market issues, what I meant is that the bottom line of that is that we're not connected to the lower 48 hub. And so I'll just give you an example. If there were three companies out exploring for gas right now in the basin, which there are, and one of those companies ended up finding a 2 TCF gas field, 2 trillion cubic feet of gas, the ability for the local market, for the market that's currently in existence, that would totally overwhelm the market. And so it would, again, you know, prior to, as early as 10 years ago, when gas was about $1.50 an MCF, we would be put into, again, a stranded gas situation, unless there is an export market or others. As far as what we can do about that, that's a very good question. From that standpoint of the market, without expanding that market, without having a larger consumer base, one of the issues, of course, with NSTAR, and NSTAR is paying a significant amount, they're paying, you know, associated with the lower 48 prices, without without expanding that market, without the ability to expand that market, it's going to be very hard for an exploration company to come up, because all the potential that I've talked about today, it's not the easy gas. It's going to be relatively expensive to find that gas. And so the companies are risking a significant amount of money to go out and explore for that. And without a wide open market where they can sell as much gas as they can produce, that's a fairly risky venture.
And if I may follow up.
Sure.
And as I understand, any projections of power, gas use for power generation or heating or anything is incremental. Mm-hmm. And that it would take a large industrial user,
yes,
to provide a large enough market. And we're whipsawed here because we're going to have some people come and tell us we got to expend X number of billions for either a spur line or a bullet line, when in fact there may be more gas than we will need for all of our domestic needs in Cook Inlet for all of my lifetime and maybe yours. And so here we need to know what gas is out there as we try, and if we have a solution there as opposed to a very expensive gas pipeline. And a similar question is, some people have told me that the structures are good east of Swanson River Field, out of the federal lands, you know, and that nobody has ever really asked to go out there and look. You know, so we have the same dilemma.
Sure.
We may have a close solution to our significant problem, mm-hmm, but we don't know. And how do we, what do we do?
Yep. Through the chair, Senator Dyson. They're very, very good points that you raise. It's a very complicated interactive system. There's no question about it. One thing, the expiration for gas, to answer the question about in the Moose Range, the expiration for gas, the oil potential in that part of the basin is probably fairly limited. The gas potential, I mean, it depends on who's looking at the data. The data is relatively limited. There's not much data out there to, yeah, even look at that area. But again, the exploration in the basin is in its infancy, really. And so I would assume, and I know Marathon, if I remember right, Marathon actually has, when they drilled Wolf Lake Number 1, which is outside of the Swanson River unit, an expansion of that unit, had approached the federal government to do that expansion. And I think they got that approved. And they also shot some 3D seismic in that area. So there has been some activity. To answer the first part of your question, I am not an expert on market. I'm not even close to an expert on market. There are experts on this whole issue in the Division of Oil and Gas, and they, like I said at the very beginning, they are truly working very hard to try to understand all of those issues and what we can do. And I would encourage that they had a chance to address the committee. I hesitate on suggesting on what can be done. I do. I mean, there's a lot of other issues, a lot of economic issues, a lot of all those market issues that I'm not an expert at all.
Yeah, but you're a lot closer to any of us. And we really need your wisdom,
yeah,
here, because we don't have enough information to make very important decisions, mm-hmm, and resist decisions that there's no going back.
I completely understand.
Is there anything we should do to get you all empowered to go out and get more information if the explorers aren't willing or are in a position economically to do it?
Right now, the state of Alaska, through the chair, I'm sorry, the state of Alaska is actually putting a significant amount of money into helping us understand what the potential is. We just started a program. We're spending about $300,000 a year on going and looking at the specifics of the geology to look at that next phase and that next type of exploration play that will provide those prospects that can be drilled. So we are putting a significant amount of work into that. I've just hired a new geologist that's an expert at this, at non-marine systems, to go and look at this. And as well as the Division of Oil and Gas is just in the very final phases of doing this study on the market and trying to understand what all the different intricacies of the market are and help you with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Thank you, Senator Dyson. Senator Wilikowski and Senator Wagner.
Thank you. If I understood you correctly, and I know you're not a market expert, but is it your understanding that there, just because of the nature of the gas, because it is essentially stranded, we have no access or very limited access to exporting our gas, that there really is not very much incentive for oil companies, gas companies, to drill in this area?
Through the chair. Excuse me, I'm losing my... Do you mind if I take a drink of water here real quick? Thanks. Too much talking. I think the recent activity that we have seen in the basin, there's been, and you saw the graph that showed the exploration wells and the number of wells, we saw in this spike at the very, very last few years here. That certainly is associated with the gas price. That is associated with the gas price that is out there. For many, many, many years, the spot market, if you will, was in the dollar MCF or $1.50 an MCF or $2 an MCF for that gas. Very, very different than what we're seeing down south. Now, as I understand it, that gas price is hooked to essentially the oil price. And so when we see the oil price go up, and again, I'm speaking well outside of my expertise, when we see that rise, we see an increase in gas price. So there certainly is incentive for companies to go out and do that exploration, and we've seen that increase in exploration. If I can make an analogy, because the market is small in comparison with other areas in the world, it's like a small pipe, and we had a huge funnel there, and the water was coming in, and the funnel was almost full of water. And it was coming through at a relative rate. There was a lot of gas out there. There wasn't a lot of exploration going on. Now that funnel is almost down to the spout. And if we were to fill that funnel up again, because we aren't going to be changing that the size of that hole, it ends up becoming stranded again. And so there's certain, that's somewhat of a disincentive to go out and look for additional gas. Now, if you're able to expand that the size of the hole leaving the funnel, it's a very, very different story. Then all of a sudden, it increases the exploration effort significantly. That's a geologist's market analysis.
Senator Wagner?
Bob, maybe you could tell the committee a little bit about gas storage. True, there's a limited market, but there's also now, since the negotiations with the feds and everything and with the Kenai Field, yes, there is an availability for storage of gas once it's produced, and maybe tell them how that ties in with the additional exploration production so they can keep their wells going.
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Wagner. The gas storage, which is an important part of the basin overall deliverability and production, I think both at the Swanson River field now and the Kenai gas field both have storage capabilities and permits. One of the issues with the NSTAR and the Chugach contracts is that because of the incredible swing in those demands, we have a swing of almost three. So in other words, it needs three times as much gas in the cold, dark winter months when people are heating their houses and have their lights on and all that than we do in the summer months. And so when there were lots and lots of gas wells with lots of deliverability, that was not an issue. There was always excess deliverability. And I think oil and gas would show you a number of slides that show that we are approaching that deliverability curve. So in other words, the amount of holes that are in the rock that are producing gas are becoming less because we're seeing more water come in and all those different issues. And so the deliverability in the cold winter months, what happens is we don't have enough deliverability for the local market, and we have to shut down the export market to satisfy that. What the storage does is that we take that deliverability in the times when we were not have that huge demand, and we take that gas and put it back into other reservoirs and that are not producing currently. And then when we have that very, very high demand, then we, instead of shutting down the export, we pump it back out of where we had stored it. And so it lessens that swing in other words, in the problems in deliverability.
And I'm sorry, Senator Wagner.
Yeah, and just carry it on a little bit further. That's what I've been trying to figure out, what Escapeda knows that we don't know, because if they think there's enough gas there to bring in a jackup rig of some kind and explore and start producing that gas, what kind of a market are they looking at? That's the question I've been asking, and I haven't gotten any answers on that.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Wagner, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer for that. I mean, I think one of the issues, again, is that when we start talking about reserve sizes, and when we were looking at the basin-wide scale, and I showed where we had between 0 and 15 TCF for a basin with a mean number of 3.5 TCF, that goes all the way down to the prospect level. And when an explorationist looks at a prospect that he wants to have drilled, he has to do that same probabilistic analysis about how much gas is in that prospect. And so you will say, okay, I have a 95% chance that it's bigger than, you know, 200 BCF, and I've got a 5% chance that it's as big as 20 TCF, and my mean number is, you know, somewhere around 5 or 6 TCF. And that, from the prospect level, that really depends on how much data that you have. And if you have a wide distribution like that, you most likely don't have a lot of data that you're basing those assessments on. As far as the market, that's a good question to ask Escapeda. I'm not sure. But there is exploration going on. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, this, it's a totally hopeless case and there's no place to sell your gas. That's not the case. I mean, you saw the huge amount of gas that we use. In fact, here's a breakdown of what the market is in the basin. There is a lot of places to sell your gas. Agrium certainly has been looking for gas for a number of years now.
Yes.
And so that there is a market. It's the huge discoveries that would make a difference. It's not the smallest discoveries of 50 to 100 BCF. Those are very, very lucrative, and they will be for the foreseeable future. It's when a huge, huge discovery is made that would make a difference on the market and create a stranded gas situation again.
Yeah.
So there is exploration.
Senator Wilkowski, in just one moment, let me just make a mention that, as I understand it, though, there's a relatively dynamic interface between the producers and NSTAR in those peak periods of people and cell phone, I mean, all that connectivity to make sure it's in the lines. Is that accurate portrayal?
Chairman Huggins, I really don't know the details on the market. I was not in that part of the business at all. But I do know that there are days that it is.
There are some management challenges on cold days.
I do know that there are days that it is very challenging.
Right. Senator Wilkowski.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I've heard that, you know, our gas prices in South Central have increased 70-75% in the last 3 years. And I've heard that we're actually exporting LNG to Asia for less. We're charging less exporting than the consumers of South Central are paying. Is that accurate?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I have not kept track of the market prices close enough to really know the answer to that. I do know that oil and gas has all those numbers, and they truly do understand that. But I don't have an answer for that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, there is some validity to that. If for the committee members in the audience, over the next 45 days, it's our intent to shine a bright light on Cook Inlet from multiple perspectives, so that we can take a look and ask. Because, as Senator Dyson pointed out, the business of gas and how important it is, and the proposal by a system to bring in a super expensive pipeline, when you look at your data and some of the indicators, you go, golly, what would that gas cost? And would it be competitive based on what's in Cook Inlet? But in the same token, we're all concerned because of what's happening with NSTAR. So it's very dynamic, and we're going to hear from multiple players that will hopefully shine a bright light on that for us. Senator Wagner.
Well, no. In addition to what Senator Dyson brought forward and talked about, one other thing you got to throw into that factor, that LNG plant is already permitted. That could be turned around and be a receiving station. And in some places in the world for gas for LNG, they're paying $0.50 to $0.75 per MCF. And once you run that through that process, it may be cheaper to bring gas in by LNG, put it in there and regasify it, put it in the system, than it would be to bring gas from the slope, too.
Yes,
so
yes.
There's all kinds of avenues we got to look at.
Yep. Any other courses of action out there on LNG? No. Hey, you're absolutely right. And that's what's so, to me at least, what's so captivating about the information is there is not a simple answer to where we're headed in the future. And the good news is there appears to be significant gas in Cook Inlet to be able to explore and find it. What it costs and the variables in that with the producers is a question mark. But you tell us it's there to some extent. The potential for it is there.
Sure. The potential is certainly there.
I ask you about methane. Could you give us a 45-second burst or less on methane?
A stick out? The difference that we see in gas from the North Slope and the Cook Inlet is very simple. All the gas that we see in the North Slope is what's called thermogenic gas. That means that a marine organism rained down on the ocean floor for many hundreds of thousands of years, was buried, was cooked, and it expelled both oil and gas. That's thermogenic gas, and it requires that heat and burial depth. In the Cook Inlet, because we're in a non-marine system and we have those incredible number of coals all the way through the section, what happens is that as those coals are being formed, the bugs are eating on the plant material and produce methane. Not a significant amount, but when you take it over 5 mile thick stratigraphy like that, it's a significant amount of methane gas. It's totally biogenic. It was not cooked. It wasn't produced because of the cooked. It was produced because of the bugs. What happens is when you bury that to a certain depth, it becomes dissolved in the local in situ waters, as well as within and absorbed onto the coals. When you uplift that with a structure, it releases the pressure, it comes out of solution, and then migrates up into the structures. And biogenic gas is totally non-thermogenic and has a very, very different history of generation and migration than the thermogenic gas that we see on the North Slope.
That makes sense to everybody?
We'll have a test on that Monday afternoon.
Say again?
We'll have a test on that Monday afternoon.
Well, the one thing that I do remember, it was a controversial subject in Mat-Su.
Oh, yes.
And I think it's migrated to the north up around the park, so for what that's worth. Other questions or comments for Bob? If I might. I have an email here from a person that knows of Bob and the work he's done, and quite frankly, you exceeded what this person projected, and it was very complimentary of you, because when you and I talked and Sharon, we were concerned about how many people would go to sleep on your slides. We didn't hear any snoring, and the audience appeared to be pretty good, so for that good, we appreciate, sir.
I was just going to follow up, kind of basically, correct me if I'm wrong, what you've basically said is there's still gas in Cook Inlet, but there's no more cheap gas in Cook Inlet. And that's why industry is looking for other sources and other avenues to pursue if they continue to operate there.
Sure.
Right.
So that's...
Right. Yes. Yeah, very important. But, Bob, you exceeded our expectation and being able to maintain our interest. We appreciate that very much. And in the sense that you mentioned coal a number of times, one of the things that we're going to hear is from Agrium and the support train it would take to get coal to Agrium for potential gasification to make Agrium work. That's an important piece that I think most of us would agree on, but it's a milestone also in the fact that we'll be able to use some of our coal.
Sure.
But it takes a lot of infrastructure to make that. It could be expensive, but that's on a future date. Sharon, anything else? Yeah. On Monday, we'll be hearing from the Regulatory Commission. Another chapter in Cook Inlet. Thank you very much. And this...